Fidel breaks his silence, and Governor Scott releases his budget. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. We discuss the week that was and dig behind the news and newsmakers making those headlines. 6 weeks after President Obama announced changes to America's Cuban policy, Fidel Castro writes a letter saying he does not reject the effort, and his brother insists Guantanamo Bay must be given back to Cuba. Governor Scott wants to cut taxes, spend more money, and reduce the state government's payroll in his new budget. How do education, the environment, and health care make out in the spending plan? Plus, the growing tension in the governor's cabinet over hiring and firing as criticism continues building over personnel changes at the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. It's all ahead on the Florida Roundup, next on WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. This week, the world heard from Fidel Castro. In his first public comments attributed to him since the U.S. began its effort to normalize diplomatic relations. But it wasn't an interview or an hours-long speech. Castro wrote a letter. Meantime, in Washington, D.C. this week, legislation was introduced into the United States Senate that would eliminate the American ban on travel to Cuba if approved. MasterCard and American Express, meantime, began processing credit card transactions in Cuba. And while U.S. diplomats expressed reserved optimism about their first round of talks back in Havana, Raul Castro warns that America must return the Guantanamo Naval Base and pay damages for more than a half century of what he calls economic harm, thanks to the U.S. trade embargo. Was this just another week in the new day of trying to restore diplomatic relations between America and Cuba? And after last week's talks, are the Cuban demands a step backward or to be expected? Are the American steps just moving too fast for the Cuban regime and perhaps maybe for South Florida? Let us know here on the Florida Roundup by joining the conversation at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. You can join us via Twitter as well, at WLRN, or online, our web chat at WLRN.org. Our America's editor here at WLRN, Tim Padgett, joins us for this part of the Florida Roundup, also joined by Maria Elvira Salazar, host of Maria Elvira on Mira TV. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Fidel's letter said, quote, "We will always defend cooperation and friendship with all the peoples of the world, among them our political adversaries." Tim, how significant is this comment?
I think the news here is that this really wasn't news. Fidel is right now more irrelevant, in my opinion, than he's ever been. When Obama made this announcement on December 17th that he wanted to normalize relations with Cuba, we didn't hear from Fidel. I think 10 years ago, that would have been a big thing. Mm-hmm. Where's Fidel? Nobody really seemed to care all that much. And then when he finally broke his silence this week and weighed in on this, it really wasn't a big deal either.
Maria, why 6 weeks? Everybody wondered about where Fidel was on December 17th, and there's been plenty of rumors since then about the death of Fidel. Here was this letter 6 weeks after the fact.
Thanks for having me. Well, the first thing we have to understand or really find out if indeed that letter was signed by Fidel and if those comments were really from Fidel Castro. You have to remember that the State Department said a few days ago that they do not know if that letter was signed by Fidel.
We haven't had any independent verification and likely won't.
And there was not even a picture, because not only the letter that Fidel sent to, apparently he sent to the University of Havana students, but he met with Fray Beto. Fray Beto is this Catholic priest who is very a big sponsor of the theology of the Teología de la Liberación, the liberation theology. Mm-hmm. And he has interviewed Fidel many times. And apparently he was in Havana a couple of weeks ago and he met with Fidel. And that came out 3 days ago.
Yeah.
But we haven't seen what he said to Fray Beto. Fray Beto hasn't given any interviews. And on top of that, there was not a picture. Last year, in February 14th of 2014, there was a picture when Fray Beto went to see Fidel. So why don't we see a picture today?
It's been about a year since Fidel Castro has been seen or heard of from himself as a primary source in public, Tim. I mean, as you mentioned, the longer he stays perhaps behind the written word that is attributed to him, the less relevant he becomes.
No, the fact that Raul would have come out in December and say, yes, this is what we're doing, without having Fidel's public blessing there, I think just solidifies the fact that really Fidel is no longer the player that he once was when it comes to forming these, you know, these new policies on the island. And his weighing in this week was really just sort of a formality.
Yeah, and so how important is that, not only in terms of the diplomacy, but also in terms of the Cuban people?
It used to be important that Fidel weigh in as a matter of policy. Now it's only important as a matter of symbolism. Mm-hmm. It was almost as if Raul and the Cuban government were saying, you know, it's been 6 weeks. It'd be nice if Fidel sort of chimed in and said, I support this too. But to tell you the truth, if he hadn't, it really wouldn't have had much of an effect at all on what's going on.
Maria, is this a tacit acknowledgement by the Castro regime that they have no option except to engage in this diplomatic dance with the Americans that they haven't in public in more than a half century?
I don't know how can we really read this, because there is something that's still, while Tim was talking, I was thinking, more than giving a tacit approval to what the United States offered on December 17th, is the fact that the five spies that was Fidel's
the Cuban five.
The five Cuban
that
five
were convicted of espionage here in Florida.
In Florida, and they were prosecuted and convicted by a federal a court in the United States.
And the three remaining who were in jail on December 17th were sent back as part of the spy swap.
And two of them finished their sentence, and they were
and
able
were
to go
back
to Cuba.
That's right.
But you know, the fact that we did not see Fidel visiting or smiling with them on a picture it speaks volumes. So that,
and what is it telling you?
And that is what tells me is that we do not know if in reality Fidel is still alive, number one, or he is in a mental condition to really be able to either receive Fray Beto or write a letter to the students or give his approval or his disapproval to what's happening with Washington.
Well, we do know his brother is certainly front and center in Costa Rica this week. The day after the letter from Fidel was published, Raul, the president, laid down some demands: give Guantanamo back to Cuba, drop the trade embargo entirely. Pay damages to Cuba for nearly a half century of economic pain he assesses caused by the United States. Is this from the old playbook, Tim?
Sure. There was a lot of hysteria on the Twitter sphere when he came out and said this. And I think one of the big misconceptions was that somehow these demands Raul was making were going to derail the normalization process. And what that really tends to misunderstand is that the normalization process, you have to think of it on sort of two levels. The one level is the effort to reestablish diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Things like, you know, reopening embassies, setting the ground rules for how each of our diplomatic personnel will operate in each country.
Allowing banking to go on, just in terms of the embassy in Washington,
exactly.
D.C., for instance.
The nuts and bolts of reestablishing ties. On the other level, there's a broader level, which is normalization, normalizing relations between the two countries. And on that level is where you see the two countries expressing their priorities, their aspirations, their demands for how they want these relations to be conducted. On the U.S. side, for example, demanding that Cuba improve its human rights record, mm-hmm. that it expand its private sector. And then what you're seeing from the Cuban side are things like what Raul said this week. Well, we'd love to have Guantanamo back. Probably not going to happen.
Well, we'd love to have it. We want it back for normalized relations.
Right. What he's saying is for relations to be genuinely normalized between the United States and Cuba, once we've reestablished diplomatic ties, these are the kinds of things we'd like to see happen.
Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Maria Elvira Salazar with Mira TV along with us. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Join that conversation, 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, on Twitter at WLRN and online at WLRN.org. Maria, I have to ask about the comments, the placement of the comments. They were in Costa Rica. Raul Castro was there at the Community of Latin America and Caribbean States. Is this an effort to exert some political regional influence that Cuba still matters within the Caribbean basin?
I think that what Raul said in Costa Rica is playing the old movie. We have seen time after time, every time the United States has tried to really make an interesting and serious and rigorous approach to reestablish relations with Cuba, they have always stalled. It happened with Kissinger. Mm-hmm. It happened with Carter. Mm-hmm. It happened with Clinton, mm-hmm. with the Brothers to the Rescue. Mm-hmm. It's happening now.
And most of those have happened in private, in hushed, closed-door situations, certainly during the Ford administration, the Carter administration. This is the first time in a long time these things are happening on front pages.
Yeah, but you have to understand that the Clinton administration, there was a time in the early 90s that Clinton was really seriously thinking about lifting the embargo before it was codified and it was in the hands of Congress.
Right, right.
Clinton was able to, with one little pen, just sign it off and remove the embargo unilaterally. And what happened? In February of 1995, mm-hmm. the Brothers to the Rescue mm-hmm. planes were shot down.
Yep.
So right there. Put so now I think we're seeing the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm sure that Tim agrees.
Yeah.
So now it's like not mm-hmm. only you have to go to Congress and tell them to lift it, which is, we know that in this country, thank God, doesn't work that way. Number two, you have to pay me $65 billion
right.
that you owe me for being bad to me economically. You have to shut down Radio and TV Marti, that some Congress and senators like it. And on top of that, so now you give me your mom, your dad, and your children.
But is this though part of this international chess game that one has to expect after 54 years of animosity and distrust?
Right.
Cuba's afraid.
Fear at this point.
And you're talking about a regime that whose priority in this process is making sure that they can control the process, because that's what this regime is all about, is being able to control. You've also got a lot of old, very hardline generals around Raul who are expecting him to keep control of this situation. And this is the kind of rhetoric that he's got to express to show that, yes, he's still sort of in tough guy control.
Let's talk a little bit about process. Roberta Jacobson is the senior State Department official leading the American delegation. She stopped in Miami after leaving Havana on Saturday last week. And while here, she described Cuba's new private entrepreneurs as key to America's new engagement policy.
There's no doubt in my mind that they all see themselves as playing a critical role in demonstrating a different way of economic prosperity than a state-centered model.
That may be the long-term goal, but the real tough negotiations still lie ahead, especially as it relates to human rights.
Our intention was to make sure they understood what our position was. That's the area of the most profound disagreement.
So, Maria, how does human rights and the fundamental disagreement, even what that the definition of that term is in Cuba versus what we think it means for Cubans and what it means to Americans, how does that threaten these talks, even at this early stage?
I think this time this administration understands that if we start asking for what's not possible, is going to stall and is going to destroy the talks. So I think that the Obama administration this time took another route to get to the same point, which is we know that, and I have no doubt that my community and your audience is very much divided. My mom thinks that this is treason.
Mm-hmm.
My cousin thinks that this is the best thing that could have happened to us. I think that the United States is in a very difficult position because at the same time, we are the beacon of liberty in the world, and we got to maintain that flag. But we know that if we hold that flag, and that's all we do, we will never get to the goal, which is making the Cubans just like the rest of Latin America. So I think that Roberta has a difficult position. And I think that what she did in Cuba was very symbolic. Not only she went to talk to the Cubans and to the government, and she met with this lady, Josefina Vidal, who I don't know if you know that her husband was expelled from Washington because he was caught spying.
Right.
So that's very telling who you're sitting in front of,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
this lady is a diplomat. Mm-hmm. All right, fine. And then not only that, Roberta finished with Josefina, but then she goes and she walks. I think that's very symbolic. She walks to meet with Cardinal Ortega, that we know that the Catholic Church is the only institution that has some independence.
And the reason why she walked and why that optic is important here is because of the physical limitations that are put on U.S. diplomatic interests that are in Havana. They can't go for a walk in the neighborhood without notifying the Cuban central government and having the minders around them. So in this case,
Jim Carson never paid attention to what they were telling him.
Nor can they leave Havana.
Just
like they cannot leave Washington, the Washington area.
But Maria, you speak about the change in tactic by the Obama mm-hmm. administration compared to previous administrations, which is perhaps step by step toward the longer term goal of human rights. But I want to get down to this point
which
here.
Which is not always well seen by this community,
well,
you understand.
Sure. I mean, when we saw that December 17th, and we've seen it since, but we have seen the evolution of this community in South Florida and
Absolutely.
The engagement, no doubt about it. But I want to get to this point of human rights, because I think this is an important point, although it does get down to definition. And you hear it in the language of Vidal, who's the lead negotiator in Cuba, talking about what they define as human rights, and you hear about it from Roberta Jacobson from the State Department about the American definition of human rights.
Well, you know, come on, you know, there is only one human rights definition.
Sure. What Vidal and the Cubans are trying to do here is to try to have this human rights discussion on their terms.
Absolutely.
At the table, what they're telling the Americans is, well, wait, before you lecture us on human rights, let us lecture you on
sure.
your human rights
right.
problems. Ferguson, Missouri, torture at Guantanamo, mm-hmm. et cetera. But what Jacobson and the Americans are saying is, let them grandstand like that, because as this process goes on, particularly when later this year they're going to have this formal dialogue, debate between the experts of the two countries over human rights specifically, as this goes on, the Cubans are going to find it harder and harder to grandstand this way and sort of justify their own human rights record.
Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us on WLRN. Maria Elvira Salazar with Mira TV along with us on the Florida Roundup. Join the conversation, 800-743-9576. Jorge is joining us from Miami. Jorge, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hello?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I just simply want to state the Cuban community doesn't think equally. You know, this is not the times of 1907, but the Monroe Doctrine, as we saw with the Malvinas thing, the Platt Amendment that was then 1907. You know, this we can't go back and we can't look at things like we did. And the frozen monies that Chase Manhattan is holding, you know, we have to do a clean slate and start over. I mean, Cubans here are no different in opinion. But you know, we have to put our feet on the ground and look at reality.
Jorge, do you support this re-engagement that the administration has
absolutely.
Begun?
Absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely. Because if we don't, we go backwards. And the manifest destiny that I look at inside the island, it will take place. It's a process. Human rights. It's a thing that takes time, and for them to yield, you know, take and yield and give. You know, we have a community here that likes to be an obstacle. And every time we have a little progress, they like to be, continual obstacle. And we can't continue like that.
Oh,
and I applaud Obama for doing what he's doing. And I hope the Congress gets their thing together and do the right thing.
Jorge with Miami, we appreciate the input.
Thank
here.
You,
speaking
sir.
Of Congress, in fact, the U.S. Senate, some senators are beginning to take some legislative steps here. On Capitol Hill, the U.S. Senate this week began taking steps legislatively to engage with China, with Cuba.
We're introducing today legislation to repeal in its entirety the Cuba
right.
Cuba travel ban.
That is Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake. He's the lead sponsor of this bill.
Some will say that we ought to receive something in exchange for this, that if we're giving up something, then we ought to get some concession from the Cuban government. I think it's we all need to remember that this is a sanction or a prohibition on Americans, not Cubans. And it's to expect the Cuban government to react with some concession when we're not offering a concession. We're simply saying that Americans should be allowed to have the right to travel wherever they would like to, unless there's a compelling national security reason.
Another kind of development in this diplomatic dance, Tim, where the Senate now, and Republicans in the Senate, it was a combined Republican and Democrat
right.
news conference that we saw. First, the political lens of that coming out of Arizona. We had an Illinois Democrat, and we had a Democrat from New England included in this legislation.
No, but Jeff Flake, the Republican senator from Arizona, who really is the lead sponsor of this bill to eliminate the travel ban, I think he's one of the strongest advocates really for bringing down the embargo. I mean, I remember spending time with Flake back in the 1990s in Cuba when he would go in and talk to Cuban officials and joke with them and say things like, "You guys better behave, or you know what? We're gonna eliminate the embargo," because his point being, we know that you love this embargo, mm-hmm. because it gives you a scapegoat, mm-hmm. for all of your screw ups and your repression, etc.
We got a tweet from a listener using to us at WLRN. The embargo isn't working, has not weakened Cuban government, and harms the population. Maria, that's a very common certainly feeling here in South Florida.
And we've been hearing it for years.
Right.
And by this time, I think many people believe that the embargo is the very big scapegoat. But one of the things I think we have to look in the next 2 years, which I think we're going to really encounter a big fight between the Republicans and the White House, I mean, Congress and the White House, we will see how the Republicans are really going to behave. Because you have to remember that the Chamber of Commerce, the United States Chamber of Commerce, is in the hands of Republicans. Mm-hmm. And Republicans, Ford and Sheraton, people, specifically Ford, they want to sell cars, lots of cars, to the Cubans. Those cars are pretty old, yeah. in the streets of Havana.
But it's not just
right?
Ford.
And
I
number
mean,
two,
every
and then you
consumer
need,
goods company.
Absolutely.
Every,
and we need soap and detergent.
Every hospitality company wants hotels there. Yeah.
Holiday Inn,
sure.
and Western
restaurants.
So then what's going to happen to Marco and to Bob? And I have been asking them.
Senator Rubio, Senator Nelson.
That's right. Yes. Senator Rubio, Senator Bob Menendez.
You may be on first term, first
that's
name
right.
terms.
No, I'm
them,
not. I'm not. But, you know, I think that our audience knows them. Ileana, Congressman for District 26,
right.
Ileana Ross-Layton, and Diaz-Balart. What within their party, what's going to happen when those senators and congressmen are going to tell them, we know, right. and we believe that human rights is our number one goal. But look at China. We need to sell cars in Havana. Come on, Ileana. Mm-hmm. Give us a hand here. This is the way to get into the House.
And that's what the opponents will point out. Look at the engagement with China. Look at the engagement with Vietnam. Look at the engagement with other countries who have awful human rights records, no doubt about it. But they're not in the hemisphere. They're not 90 miles from our shores. And we don't have a half century worth of trade embargo history to get beyond.
Oh, right. And what I think the argument they're making is that, you know, there's a larger question here about our relations with Latin America. And the fact that we do engage China, that we do engage Vietnam, it makes us look hypocritical then when we're turning around and not, in, you know, trying to isolate Cuba. It just makes it look as if Cuba is some sort of special evil case. Mm-hmm. And that resonates very negatively throughout the rest of the region. And that's why
a
lot of people think that this will help our relations with the region.
But you know what happens is that we can't afford it to be who we are. Mm-hmm. In Cuba, we can't afford it to be morally correct. Unfortunately, in China, we cannot, because it's a very big market.
Much different scale of economics there.
We have no doubt that in the United States, that this country really wants to do good,
right?
We know that.
And that's
we cannot do that good in China because of economic reasons. But in Cuba, we can't afford to do it. Morally
when you say we can afford to do it, but then the way that a lot of Latin American governments look at it, though, is you don't bully China because you can't. You do bully Cuba because you can.
Absolutely.
And that's what bothers
them. Phone call in here. Joaquin is joining the conversation.
I'm going to tell you another
plantation. Joaquin, yeah. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Yes, good evening. How are you? I just wanted to comment and maybe what do you think? What do we tell the Cuban Americans who suffer greatly at the hands of the Castro regime? This is like rewarding the Castro regime, and you have to put yourself on the shoes of those who, like I say, suffer under that regime.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Joaquin, you
got
it
right
point.
On the money.
Yeah. And not only the economic suffering in terms of the seizure of properties in the 50s and 60s and the seizures of businesses and bank accounts and all those, but of course it is the tragedy of family members
dying
at the hands of the Castro regime.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, while Raul Castro this week talked about you must hand over Guantanamo and you must shut down Martí and you must pay us billions of dollars in reparations for the economic harm from the trade embargo, we haven't heard the State Department say, well, you must pay reparations to the hundreds of thousands of Cubans that have been impacted economically and personally by the half century of brutal dictatorship and repression
and division. I remember my grandmother that she suffered for 20 years because she couldn't talk to her brother, Louis. So I grew up, because I am I'm a son of daughters of the first wave.
Right.
So I know what the listener is talking about.
And so Joaquin poses that question, what do you tell? What does the State Department tell? What does the administration tell those Cuban Americans that still have those wounds fresh even after 50 years? And I think we heard a little bit of that from Senator Flake saying, you know, we want to lift the travel ban. And for those that say we're not getting anything in return, this travel ban is against Americans.
Well, I think
that's what we're addressing.
What
here.
Politicians like Flake are saying is that we would have loved to have seen regime change in Cuba, but it's a battle that we lost, and that this new policy is not about, you know, necessarily changing Cuba while the Castros are still alive. It's about positioning the United States much more effectively for the moment when they're gone. And we can take better advantage of sort of Gorbachev-like elements beginning to emerge during the transition. And I think that's the point that the Obama administration also is trying to
but
make.
But I do want to believe that besides the economic opportunities that opening the Cuban market to the American companies, the White House is also interested in bringing democracy and freedom and human rights and civil rights to the Cubans. There is this phrase called the Cuban exceptionality that the Cuban government has been trying to sell for years to the United States and to Europe, meaning that the other 27 countries in Latin America have democracy and you can go home for Christmas. But Cubans are happy because we are an exception.
Right, right.
There's no exception. And I think that the United States, the Obama administration, Republicans and Democrats, I want to give them the benefit of the doubt that they do want to bring that to Cuba. Now, the question is how? How do we bring the human rights in 25 years from now?
The human rights, the democracy, and the economic freedom.
Freedom,
and the liberties
yes.
that go along with all of that. It is a
now will the economic freedom will bring that after? That's the big question, because the Canadians and the Mexicans and the Spaniards have been there for 20 years,
right.
putting money into the island. And but you know, Americans, we are the American exceptionality. When the Americans arrive, like, you know, everybody consumes Coca-Cola and Nike. So
it is a high stakes global diplomacy played out 90 miles from our shores here, watching it with WLRN, Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us, and Maria Elvira Salazar with Mira TV. Thanks, Maria. We appreciate you coming in today here on the Florida Roundup. Stick with us. Plenty more to come. A little domestic politics and spending. Governor Rick Scott's $77 billion budget cuts taxes and cuts state jobs. Back on the Florida Roundup on WLRN, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Governor Scott wants to spend $77 billion running the state of Florida for the next fiscal year. His plan is to cut taxes, increase state dollars going toward education and the environment, but eliminate more than 1,000 state jobs.
Our budget reflects the priorities I spoke about during the campaign last year. It is a strong budget because our economy is strong. The way we keep our economy growing even stronger is to give families back more of the money they already made.
As the governor looks for support in Tallahassee and around the state for his budget, there's growing discontent over how he handled the departure of the state's top cop late last year. Members of Scott's own cabinet say they were misled by the governor's office over changes made at the top of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. So what's going on inside the governor's spending plan, inside the governor's office and staff? What taxes would you like to see cut? Is the state providing adequate service with fewer state employees? Join the Florida Roundup on the telephone, 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. You can send us a tweet as well, at WLRN. Steve Bosquet covering the capital city for the Tampa Bay Times. Gary Fineout doing the same for the Associated Press, both with us from Tallahassee. So let's start with the budget here, guys. $673 million in tax cuts. Gary, where are the tax cuts coming from?
Well, there's a few key areas. The biggest chunk of the tax cut would be a reduction in what we call the communication services tax. That is a tax that's charged on a whole array of services, but primarily for most people, it's a bill. It shows up on your cell phone bill, and it shows up on your cable TV or your satellite dish bill.
So this is the line item that says Florida state taxes on your monthly cell phone bill. It's about, for cable TV, I think it's a little over 9% of the base charge. This is almost a half billion dollars in taxes. Seems like a pretty good sizable tax cut for a relatively common expense.
Florida does have one of the higher percentage rates of taxes in this area. So, yes, it is something that most people pay, and most people would get some savings, although they were quick to point out that probably the average Floridian would save about $40 a year if these taxes were cut the way that the governor wants them.
Not exactly a windfall for most families.
Maybe, not a huge windfall.
Yeah, maybe a tank of gas.
And then the other tax cuts that he's looking at is he's looking at doing the 3-day sales tax holiday. He's looking at exempting sales tax completely, a permanent change to get rid of the sales tax on college textbooks. He does want to make permanent it's a sales tax exemption for manufacturing equipment. That was passed, but it was only made temporary. He wants to make that permanent. And so those are the biggest portions. Now, I would also note that the governor's budget does rely upon a rise in property values to help pay for his increases to the schools. And I know, especially in South Florida, that has been a hot topic in recent years. I mean, before the downturn, it was a big topic. But the governor is kind of wants to use the upsurge again in property values to help pay for some of his school funding.
Yeah, Steve Bosquet, let's talk about the school funding. Almost $20 billion. And Gary just lined out kind of where most of the money comes from. It's from an anticipated increase in property values, which would thus flow through toward property taxes. But where does the money go? Where does he want to spend it?
He wants to put more money into K-12, you know, per pupil spending, to bring it to a level slightly above where it was at the highest point ever, which is in the 2007-2008 fiscal year. However, interestingly enough, even some legislators have challenged Rick Scott's math. Republican legislators, Don Gates, for example, the number of students in the school system in Florida is way greater now than it was 7 years ago. There's a lot more kids in school, and so you're spreading a little bit more money among a much bigger student population.
And so let's talk a little bit more about this education spending, because there's so much focus on the total amount of spending and the per pupil spending and who did how much more and adjusted for inflation. I mean, that to me seems like a horse race. It's what are we getting? What's the return on investment for state taxpayers for the money that the Scott administration wants to spend on K through 12 education?
Well, I'll say one thing, and then I'll defer to Gary. But one of the things that is a perennial issue, because Rick Scott did address it in his first term, and that is teacher salaries.
Right.
I mean, if you're a parent with kids in public schools in the state, you probably have 10 or 12 ideas where you want to see more money spent. One of them might be, you know, more teacher aides. One of them might be a better classroom facility so kids aren't in portables. And one of them might be paying teachers more money. We're still below the national average in teacher salaries, despite the raise that Scott wanted to give them a couple of years ago.
Now, Gary Finite, I got to get to the state job cuts that the governor's budget includes here. More than 1,000 state job cuts, which continues the trend under the Scott administration, which is a leaner state government. Can the services continue to be provided at the level that the Floridians have come to expect?
I mean, to me, it's one of the intriguing factors of this, of watching his budget is, of course, the evolution of where Scott was when he first came in and where he is now. Because, yes, he is proposing continued cuts in jobs, a lot of them vacant. A big chunk of the jobs would be with county health departments, which they're contending these jobs aren't needed because we've got streamlining of these county health departments. But what's interesting is that while he was doing that, you mentioned 1,000 jobs. That's the net. It's actually he's eliminating over 1,300 positions. But the reason the net's only 1,000 is because he's adding jobs in the Department of Corrections. And what your listeners may or may not recall is 4 years ago it was, I'm going to cut the Department of Corrections by as much as by a third.
Right.
And what has happened, of course, is over the last couple of years we have seen – for lack of a better word, a series of scandals involving the way that the Department of Corrections. So he's actually proposing to add more positions in that. So to your point is that sort of a tacit recognition of we cut the Department of Corrections in the past, and here we are having to add jobs now and put money back into the prison system because of all the things that are happening.
Sue is going to join the Florida Roundup here from Fort Lauderdale talking about state proposed job cuts. Sue, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much. I just wanted to say briefly, I used to work for Miami-Dade County, and what I find with both the state and the county is that they cut jobs, and I can understand the budget and cutting jobs. When they cut the job, they cut the job of the senior employees that are close to retirement, and they keep the jobs for their friends and their political people that they have. Who actually gets cut is the little person, the person that really, really needs the job. Thank you so much.
Sue, we appreciate the comment there. Do we know, Gary or Steve, kind of the I guess, seniority level of the job cuts that the governor's proposing?
No, these are mostly these are mid-level to low-level jobs that have been vacant for a long time that are not deemed essential to the state's situation. And Rick Scott has steadily cut the size of the state workforce since he's been in office. He believes in creating jobs in the private sector, mm-hmm. not in government.
Speaking of job cuts, one job change that the governor made late last year continues to really roil the administration. Governor Scott looking to build that support for the budget. Arguably, one of the biggest controversies so far of his administration continues raging here. What exactly happened with Jerry Bailey, who until mid-December, guys, was the head of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement? Was he fired? He says he was. Did he resign? Governor Scott said this week.
Jerry Bailey was given the opportunity to step down. He did. He was given that opportunity. And then he waited until after Rick Swearingen was confirmed by the entire cabinet and made his attacks. The attacks against me are absolutely untrue, and they're ridiculous.
The attacks include Jerry Bailey essentially calling Governor Scott a liar about what happened back in mid-December. The FDLE commissioner has four bosses, all elected statewide, the Florida cabinet, including the governor. Three of those cabinet members say they did not know Bailey was going to be let go. Here's the state's chief financial officer, Jeff Atwater, this week.
If someone had said to me, tomorrow morning, we're going to walk into Commissioner Bailey's office, and we're going to offer an ultimatum, and we're going to tell him that you've lost the confidence of Mr. Atwater, and you're to be out of here by the close of business, the event would not have occurred.
The event would not have occurred, according to Atwater. The Ag Commissioner, Adam Putman, says he didn't know.
We were informed that there was an interest in making a change at FDLE, and at 9 a.m. the next morning, there was a dramatic change at FDLE. That is not at all what I envisioned when we were given a heads up about an interest in potentially making changes in cabinet agencies.
Not at all what I envisioned, says Commissioner Putnam. And then the Attorney General late this week, Pam Bondi, defended Governor Scott, but also put the blame on his staff.
Did I know that Jerry Bailey was going to be told he was fired and have his things packed up, his entire life as a career law enforcement officer, in a cardboard box and told to be out of the office before the end of the day? Absolutely not. Nor do I believe the governor knew it.
Nor do I believe the governor knew it. All right, Steve Vasque, did the governor fire Bailey?
Well, I mean, he wasn't the literal executioner. It was Pete Antonacci, his longtime attorney. But there's no question that Bailey was forced out of office. This business about he stepped down is nonsense. And, Jerry Bailey has done something you rarely see in the state of Florida. You see a high-level state official standing in the public square, pointing his finger at the elected governor in this state and say, "You, sir, are lying." And Bailey did that. And the cabinet members are still, as you see, are basically siding with Bailey here, Bailey's version of events. Bailey was told he had to get out within 3 or 4 hours. Rick Scott, no one is blameless here. The cabinet members didn't ask any good questions early on. This swept over them like a wave. It happened over the holidays, so frankly, people weren't paying close attention to it.
But Steve Vasque, how much do the commissioners themselves, the cabinet members themselves, need to ask specific questions versus how much information ought to be volunteered to them about this hiring strategy or firing
Absolutely.
Strategy?
Absolutely. This thing is going to come to a head. There's going to be a showdown next Thursday in Tampa at a cabinet meeting. And it's probably the one and only opportunity for Putnam, Atwater, and Bondi to do what the people of Florida elected them to do, and that is to constitutionally stand up and ask the right questions. This is an important – I think you mentioned it earlier on. FDLE – The reason FDLE reports to the governor and cabinet and has since 1967 is precisely to prevent the very thing that people think happened here, and that is for an independent law enforcement agency to be perceived as being under the control of one politician.
Yeah, there was some. There's push and pull here, Gary, between the FDLE and the governor's office, and there had been tension building for months between Commissioner Bailey and the governor's staff regarding many different items within FDLE as the independent law enforcement agency, and that, of course, is, I would imagine, Gary, going to be part of the independent investigation, but also the three cabinet members that are speaking out here about what exactly happened and what do the people of Florida deserve to know.
Well, I would focus on what you said there, independent investigation, which at this point in time, we don't have one going on. I mean, we have State Attorney Willie Meggs has on two different occasions been asked about the topic and has basically said he sees it as a cabinet problem. He doesn't see it as anything that rises to the level of a criminal, worthy of a criminal investigation. Now, what's interesting is that no one so far has stepped forward and says we, on the very at least, ought to have an internal investigation by either, you know, our inspector generals or anything like that. So that hasn't happened yet. But an important thing I want to relate to everyone is the deal is that the governor usually puts in the person that he wants, whether it was Scott, whether it was Jeb Bush. Mm-hmm. Normally, we don't have this kind of thing that happens. Normally, you defer to the governor. The governor and in fact, I think another way it works is the FDLE commissioner is the nominee. The governor has prerogative to put the nominee forward. It was sort of the way that this was handled.
It's the process involved here.
It's just the feeling. What you have is that basically regardless of whether or not you believe Bailey's allegations or you don't believe Bailey's allegations, part of the issue is how did this get communicated and how did this get put into action? And ultimately, did the governor and his staff act in a unilateral fashion in which they didn't respect what is the actual law in place related to these cabinet agencies? And just one final aside on that, Steve mentioned how FDLE was set up separately in the late 60s to be able to do this. Part of this, what people have to realize is in Florida, we have a very bizarre kind of arcane government system where the reason we have these cabinet agencies and these separate statewide officials from the governor stems from the late 1800s when we passed a constitution which was meant to diffuse power between everybody because, frankly, it was written right after Reconstruction, right after federal troops were here. So the idea was in the future, no one person in the executive branch was going to have all the power.
Little history lesson for us all here on the Florida Roundup about the Sunshine State Constitution dating back to the 19th century here. Gary Fineout joining us with the Associated Press and Steve Bosquet with Tampa Bay Times. Meantime here, other state agencies and leadership may be changing. There was talk about a new Office of Insurance Regulator commissioner, about the Scott administration reaching out to a state official in Louisiana. I mean, there's real questions about process, about, Steve, as you mentioned, the unilateral acting of the governor and the governor's staff, perhaps with or without the public acknowledgement of the other cabinet members.
Absolutely. You know, Rick Scott was just reelected to a second term. He's only the second Republican governor in the history of the state to win back-to-back terms, along with Jeb Bush. Instead of his second term getting off on a positive note, this has been a disaster. And what happened with the Louisiana situation is this. Kevin McCarty has been the insurance commissioner for the state since 2003. It's a tenuous, challenging job. He might be nearing the end of his shelf life in the job anyway. He's been in that job for 12 years. It's not a job you can do forever, and it's not an easy job. And his main bosses are the governor and Jeff Atwater, the chief financial officer. And you can see in Atwater's statements this week that Atwater's nose is out of joint. He's not happy. He sees no justification to get rid of McCarty. And while the cabinet members, by the way, Gary makes a good point. They do respect and they defer to the governor and say, look, he's the first among equals here. You want to make changes in a second term? You can make changes in a second term. But can't we have some logical basis of a public discussion for why you want to get rid of this guy? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there should be some substantive other than just you don't like the color of the guy's tie. So what is Rick Scott doing? Rick Scott and his staff went to Louisiana, where Scott's chief of staff and some other top officials work are from, and they did recruit the number two guy in the Louisiana Insurance Office to apply for McCarty's job. Turns out the guy that Scott was looking at was recommended to him by a lobbyist for the insurance industry who's from Fort Lauderdale, a guy named Fred Karlinski. And that's probably not the most ideal way to go about replacing a cabinet agency either.
Certainly not. In the meantime, of course, the cabinet meeting next Thursday will be perhaps a tension-filled room there in Tampa as the Florida cabinet gets together for the first time as this controversy continues roiling. Covering it for the Associated Press, Gary Fineout, and for the Tampa Bay Times, Steve Bosquet, both joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your insights. Still to come on our program, raising the Pork and Beans Public Housing Project in Miami. Back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. In the spring of 1936, the first people began moving into the Liberty Square public housing development in Miami. Now, the project began back in the early years of the Roosevelt administration. Support among the local establishment at the time in Miami was built by promising clean housing for servants and domestic laborers. In fact, in an editorial in the Miami Herald that was in the fall of 1936, it read, "There are no frills at Liberty Square, but there is sanitation and light and air and harmony of simple architecture." That was 78 years ago. The project, now referred to as Pork and Beans, may be torn down. Miami-Dade County is moving forward with plans that would raise and redevelop the neighborhood. There are more than 600 people living there today. Michael Liu is the director of the Miami-Dade Public Housing Agency, and he said that Liberty Square housing residents will not be displaced.
One of our guiding principles, if not the guiding principle, is that all residents in good standing will have a unit to return to. If you're a resident and you follow the terms of your lease, you're in good standing.
Nadege Green is covering the story for us here at WLRN. 78 years since folks moved into Liberty Square, now Pork and Beans. What are the county plans? What do we know?
We know that the county is planning to build this out in phases. One of their main concerns was not to displace residents, as has happened in the past. Yeah. And so this is going to be built out in about five phases. The first phase is actually happening in a lot that's currently empty. So when that building goes up, the first phase of the folks in the Pork and Beans are going to move over to those units. So they're going to move over as the units become available.
And is it going to be a one-for-one replacement? In other words, the 600 residents that are there now, are they all going to find equivalent housing?
That is what the county is saying. They said all residents in good standing will have a unit to move into. Good standing means that your lease is up to term, you've been paying on time, there isn't substantial damage to your unit.
There's a history, though, of these replacement strategies not working out as expected.
Right. James E. Scott Housing Complex is a major one. In 2000, they displaced over 1,000 people at that housing project, and they were told, find other housing. They received Section 8 vouchers to find other housing around the county. Many of them moved to the Homestead area. And the idea was, as these new homes are built, you guys will be able to move into them. Well, that didn't happen. For over 10 years later, many of them have never come back to the neighborhood, and those homes were never built.
Yeah, and it's still very early in the process regarding Pork and Beans, but what kind of assurances are we hearing from public housing officials that the replacement strategy this time around is going to work?
Well, they used some senior housing that they recently built as examples of building it in phases, and that this is guaranteed that, you know, these folks will be able to move in, because we're not telling them go away and then come back. They're still there, and as the project is built.
And that's
built.
A different strategy than we saw 15 years ago.
Absolutely.
Which is go from the city of Miami down to South Dade County and then come back when the housing's available.
Right.
Yeah, very different strategy. I mean, decades of trouble have happened at Pork and Beans. Deteriorating living conditions have been documented. The gang violence in the neighborhood has certainly scarred countless families and community groups, the strained relations between residents and police. What's the future of the neighborhood? What's the intent of this strategy by the county?
The idea is that this will help revitalize the neighborhood. The money that the county is investing into this is not all going to the Liberty Square housing projects. I believe it's $46 million that they're going to be devoting to that, in addition to whatever funds the developer raises. But the leftover of that is going to build single-family homes within the Liberty City area, as well as other affordable rental units. And the idea is that when these go up, this will help revitalize another pocket of Liberty City.
And we've seen this in many other communities that have had public housing from really a different era, high-density public housing that gets raised and then townhomes or single-family homes get built. That may be part of the strategy here, but what about that community effort beyond just supplementing or supplanting one home with another, that strategy to get out into the Liberty City community more?
Well, they're saying that, you know, with part of this revitalization are going to come services. So they're looking for developers who are going to come with innovative ideas that are also going to partner with services, education, maybe parent training, mm-hmm. job training, these types of things. And so that's still up in the air how that's going to actually be realized. But the county is definitely saying that we want innovative ideas. We don't want someone to come tell us we're going to build a brick and mortar project.
And there's a response from residents. Are some of them cynical enough to say, you know, we've heard these kinds of efforts before? You know, the city and the county have talked about trying to redevelop Liberty City. We've heard similar instances in Overtown, for instance, over the last several years. And as the shoreline has been built up, the downtown area and Brickell has continued to be built up and seen billions of dollars of investment, these neighborhoods have been skipped.
Well, absolutely. Residents are cautiously optimistic. They say that they know that, you know, we're dealing with county government. Sometimes they mess up, but they're hoping that this is going to work.
Nadege Green is with us here at WLRN. And thank you so much, Nadege.
Thank you, Tom.
That is the Florida Roundup here. It is produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Julia Duba. Thanks to all those who called and tweeted today. Jessica Mazeros handled the phones for us. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Our technical supervisor today, Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next with Ed Bell. Monday morning on the Sunshine Economy, it is Obamacare in South Florida. We'll talk with you then. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.